You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although the big story in China this summer is the Olympics in Beijing, it's also the second anniversary of the China-Tibet Railway, the colossal project to connect Beijing and Lhasa, the Tibetan capital. Millions of Chinese have ridden the train since it began in 2006, but some argue that, as a consequence, it's destroying Tibet's culture and religious soul. Abram Lustgarten, a contributing writer to Fortune magazine, has written a book about the train and China's seemingly unstoppable economy. It's called China's Great Train, Beijing's Drive West, and the Campaign to Remake Tibet, published by Times Books, which is an imprint of Henry Holt. And I'm delighted that it brings Abram Lustgarten to this show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Why did Beijing want to build a railroad to Tibet in the first place?
You start off with the biggest question. Many, many reasons. There's the geopolitical importance of that region. Tibet proper makes up about an eighth of China's land mass, and Tibetan region in total makes up about a quarter, and it borders all of the rest of South Asia and the Middle East.
Tibet is as big as Western Europe, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So we're talking about a pretty big area, although not all that densely populated.
A massive area, and in most places, almost completely vacant of people. The Tibetan people, of course, are in concentrated areas.
So is this seen as the next frontier as far as the Han Chinese are concerned?
It's been a frontier for China for a long time. Whether it's the next frontier, I don't know, but it is the gateway to their relations with the rest of South Asia, and it's a holder of massive resources of chemicals and stones and oil and gas.
Well, is the train intended to take advantage of all of those resources? This is a passenger train, isn't it?
There is a freight train, and it doesn't get a whole lot of attention, and it didn't get a lot of notice even in my own book. But they launched a freight train about 7 months before they launched the passenger train, and there are as many freight lines running a day as there are passenger trains.
Is this a way to flood Tibet with non-Tibetans? Is that Beijing policy?
It's difficult to say whether that's explicit Beijing policy. There's no doubt that that's one of the impacts of the railway and one of the effects of development in Tibet in general. I think that's partially what's intended.
What about positive sides? I mean, was there any altruistic thinking behind the railway, the railroad as a way of spreading the wealth from east to west?
Oh, of course. And there is an emerging middle class in Tibet, and it's brought great development, not just the railway, but the development that's preceded the railway has brought great change to Tibet in economic forms. To some degree, Tibetans are benefiting, and so are people across that region, Western China.
What kind of investment did this mean for the government in Beijing?
Well, the official numbers attached to the railroad are $4.3 billion, depending on who you believe. When I spoke with international railway experts, they speculated that it would be much, much higher, as much as four or five times that amount. And China is typically secretive about the numbers that they do put forward.
So billions of dollars for this railroad at the same time that they were starting to put billions of dollars into the Olympics. China has that kind of cash at hand?
Well, China is, as we all know, flush with cash. It's a benefactor of our economic boom and great manufacturing era, and they are willing to spend it.
How many years did it take to build this railroad?
They began in 2001 and finished in late 2005.
And Tibet, it said, sits on the roof of the world. So I would assume that made it very difficult to build a railroad. The thin air alone must have made it hard for the workers.
There's many reasons it was incredibly difficult. But the thin air, yes, they estimate that there's approximately 40% or half the amount of oxygen in the air at 15,000, 16,000 feet that there is at sea level.
And then there's permafrost on the Tibetan plateau.
Yep, permafrost. It's the largest permafrost region south of the Arctic Circle of anywhere in the world, and it's also a relatively flat permafrost region, and it's very fragile, which means it's in the process of melting every summer as it gets warmer with the summer sun. And every time it melts and freezes, it, just like any ice cube or puddle, expands and contracts, and that leads to a whole lot of upheaval on the plateau.
And what does it mean for the railroad?
Well, we'll see. In the short term, it meant some cracking and some problems soon after it was completed. They went to great technological lengths to design a railroad that might be able to sustain the kind of changes that they did foresee on the plateau. And I think there's substantial questions about whether they were able to account for the full extent of changes that they will have to deal with.
After it was finished, was there an immediate demand for seats on the train?
Oh, absolutely. I wasn't there in those immediate months afterwards, but reports were that the train was sold out for months, and I've heard that more recently as well.
And why does the average Beijing resident want to go to Lhasa?
They do, actually. Tibet is a very hot tourist destination in China domestically, and the Chinese domestic tourism industry is absolutely booming. It's a massive market. So Tibet is an extremely popular destination for Chinese tourists.
Now, what did they do when they get there? What was Lhasa like in 2006?
Well, Chinese, when they get there, do much of what we would do when we get there, and they visit monasteries. There's a great interest among Chinese in Tibetan Buddhism, and also, of course, in seeing the mountains and this incredible landscape that's there. So they do pretty much what we would do. Lhasa in 2006 was a city twice the size of Lhasa in 2001. It was fast becoming a Chinese metropolis, like many of the eastern cities, though not quite as big. New buildings, new construction, new roads, lots of new cars, increasing levels of pollution, tourist shops, everything that goes with that.
So it's the railroad has meant that Lhasa has become a boom town.
Oh, absolutely. And the development that preceded the railroad that came with the construction crews and the increased army presence, all of that led to Lhasa being a boom town.
My guest is Abram Lustgarten. His book, China's Great Train, Beijing's Drive West and the Campaign to Remake Tibet, published by Times Books. But you've ridden the train. What's it like?
Well, it's quite incredible in a lot of ways. First of all, it's a new train, which is a pleasure if you've taken trains around China. And when you get to the Tibetan Plateau itself, it is the most majestic, incredible, surreal landscape of anywhere on the planet that I've been, and I've been a number of places. And to be able to sit in a smooth-running train that's relatively quiet with a huge picture window and sip a cup of tea and look out at that landscape passing by is quite otherworldly.
How long does the trip from Beijing to Lhasa take?
About 48 hours if you go from Beijing straight through.
And are there stops along the way?
Well, there are stops in all the major cities. It's a regular train line until it gets to Golmud, the southern city in southern town, I should say, in Qinghai province. And then there are even stops in the new section of the line up and over the Tibet Plateau, but none that are typically used by passengers.
And as you go up, do you notice the change in elevation?
Well, absolutely. First of all, they supply oxygen to passengers on the train, which is an interesting thing in itself.
Because you can have altitude sickness, can't you?
You can have altitude sickness, and many people do. And the oxygen itself actually won't help much with the altitude sickness, but it will help with breathing and general alertness. And there's a hose in every seat, and you can hook it up to your nostrils and suck some oxygen. But in addition, throbbing headaches are common. High altitude pulmonary edema is a less common but frequent illness that affects many passengers. There were people sick on the train that I was on, and some people have died on the railway.
They've died?
They have, yeah.
Tibetans were promised economic opportunities. Have they materialized?
To some extent, they have. Like you said, Lhasa is a boom town.
But are the people who are cashing in most Tibetans, or are they Han Chinese who've moved to Lhasa?
They're mostly Han Chinese who've moved to Lhasa. Don't want to discount that there are some Tibetans who have benefited. But by and large, Tibetans have a difficult time getting jobs and reaping the benefits that are coming to Lhasa.
And Tibetans were forced from their homes to build this railroad, weren't they?
Many were, yes.
So did they receive any help in resettlement?
Most did, though not all. China has undertaken massive resettlement programs across Tibet, and not just for communities that were in the path of the railway, but for communities that were in places that were spread out or rural or for various other policy reasons they wanted to consolidate. Often, but not always, those communities or a family that was forced to move, let's say, would be given a cash amount to put towards their new home, but it often didn't cover the cost of moving, and it didn't account for their long-term need to make an income, having taken away their animals and their farming. And
where would they go?
After being moved, they would often be put into these large apartment blocks. For instance, outside of Lhasa, you see endless rows of what look like college dorm rooms that can house 1,000 people or 5,000 people.
Same sort of thing we've seen in many communist countries, even see it in East Berlin these days. I'm not sure what the rationale behind putting people into those ugly buildings is, other than to make them feel a little dehumanized.
I think the buildings, we would describe them as ugly simply because they were tried to be, you know, they were an attempt to build them economically. And China thinks that the reason for consolidating, that a good reason for consolidating people is to, you know, intensify urbanization and ease the environmental burden on the rural areas. And I think it makes it easier to maintain political control over the communities there.
Well, some people, including the Dalai Lama, contend that the railway is an instrument of cultural genocide. Do you agree?
I think that the impacts of overall development on Tibet have been very hard on the Tibetan people. I think that the railway itself is not necessarily such a tool. I think that it could be used or could have been used to great benefit of Tibetan people. So I'd be careful to say that the railway itself is such a kind of evil instrument. But I think that there's lots of room to be critical of China's larger policies in Tibet.
Because Tibetan culture is slipping away. What do you think the region will look like 10 years from now?
If nothing changes, unfortunately, I think that much of Tibetan identity will be lost. The monasteries are going to be preserved to some extent. There's a campaign I guess we could describe as museumification that's been happening for the last bunch of years. They'll be preserved for that reason, but whether there is a true and lively religious practice inside them is very questionable, especially in light of recent crackdowns in Tibet. The city itself, there's now what was characteristic Lhasa when I first went there is now called the inner city or the old city, and it has a gate just like Chinatown would in San Francisco or here in New York, and surrounding that is a normal Chinese sprawling city, and it continues to grow, and as it grows, the Tibetan identity inside it becomes more and more difficult to spot.
Same thing we've seen in Beijing.
Absolutely.
Where there's the museumification of the Forbidden City and then all of the old buildings, that some of them going back thousands of years, they've all been destroyed to build the new high-rises.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, I wonder what a high-rise and an elevation of that high up is like. I mean, living on the top floor, you practically don't have any air at all.
I think once you're in Lhasa, there's not much difference to be felt between the first or the 15th floor.
But aren't there plans to expand the Qinghai-Tibet line even further?
There are. There are numerous lines, some of which are under construction now. The main one is a line that will go further west through the town of Shigatse, which is the only other town that can be called a city in Tibet. And that's under construction now. And then there is talk, whether it's ever executed or not, we'll see. But there's talk of connecting the line south into Nepal.
Into Nepal?
Into Nepal.
What about other regions of China? There are all sorts of, what I might put in quotes, undiscovered parts of China, aren't there?
Mm-hmm. Well, China's expanding its railway network across the country at an elaborate pace, not just in Tibet. And even within Tibet, up on the plateau, there are several extension lines being built out to mining centers to ease the transport of those goods. And a few of the lines that were proposed when they first considered the Qinghai-Tibet Railway, there's talk of building those out as well. So it's conceivable, it may take some years, but it's conceivable that there would be several routes over the mountains from Gansu province, from Sichuan province, and even further south into Tibet.
My guest is Abram Lustgarten, who's a contributing writer for Fortune magazine. His articles have appeared in Esquire, The New York Times, Outside, Sports Illustrated, National Geographic Adventure, Salon, and many other publications. And his book is called China's Great Train, Beijing's Drive West and the Campaign to Remake Tibet, published by Times Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Abram Lustgarten. His book, China's Great Train, Beijing's Drive West, and the Campaign to Remake Tibet, published by Times Books. And things change so fast in the world. I did not know that you've left Fortune magazine. You're now with ProPublica.
I am. Yep. ProPublica is a new news organization for investigative reporting in New York.
Now, when you were traveling to Lhasa, did you speak to Tibetans?
I did as much as I could. In Tibet, where I spent considerable time, of course, I spoke with as many Tibetans as possible and focused my reporting very much on working with and speaking with Tibetans. In the rest of China, it was a little bit more difficult. And on the railway itself, I began to speak with and interview Tibetans before the police came and asked me not to.
Because you weren't always able to tell people you were a journalist or working on a book? The police would be suspicious of you?
Well, several answers to your question. Yes, the police would be suspicious. I never worked as a credentialed journalist in China or in Tibet, though I sought those credentials and was repeatedly denied them. It's not allowed to work freely in Tibet as a reporter. Most journalists get there with a government-sanctioned guide. As far as identifying myself to people that I worked with, absolutely, people that I worked closely with who became characters in my book or that I did extensive interviewing with all understood what I was working on. But on a regular basis, as I introduced myself to people, that's not a detail I would share until later on.
So you had to get past the suspicion.
Absolutely.
And the fear that they'd get in trouble as well.
Yes, absolutely. And Tibetans, for good reason, are extraordinarily cautious, and it takes a great deal to get past that suspicion to reach a point in conversation where they might feel comfortable opening up.
So how do Tibetans view China today, and what is the consensus feeling about the railroad?
Well, it varies greatly depending on who you ask. It's difficult to generalize with the exception of the railroad. The answer to that is that almost all Tibetans that I spoke with felt very negatively about the railroad. They didn't want it. They felt that it was a colonialist invasion into their territory. Several said that they could want it if, say, a Tibetan government had built it, that they would enjoy the infrastructure, the ability to travel to eastern China and so forth, but they felt pretty negatively about it in general. Beyond that, Tibetans' feelings about the Chinese, Tibetans feel a great love for the Dalai Lama. That's where most of their political and religious sentiments lie. I did not get a great sense of anti-Chinese feeling in general, though, of course, they feel persecuted religiously and would like that to end. But there was also a great fascination with a lot of Chinese culture.
Well, the Dalai Lama is 73 years old now. Do you see any chance of a resolution between him and Beijing, or is there a possibility that things might be worked out with his successor?
His age certainly raises an urgency, and Nick Kristof wrote a wonderful column this week about the possibility for some resolution that was more optimistic than most people's outlook that I had heard, and more optimistic than my own outlook. I do believe that it's a closing window of opportunity. I don't think that it'll be easy to reach any sort of political resolution with his successor. I think that, unfortunately, Tibet will probably disintegrate into a degree of mayhem if the Dalai Lama passes away without any kind of political resolution.
Now, you mentioned the cost of the railroad at, what was it, $4.3 billion?
Yes.
And we've heard $70 billion on the Olympic preparations. At that rate, is China building too fast? I mean, the producer price index just hit the highest level in 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Very difficult to say if China's building too fast. I mean, what you do have is a willingness to surge forward with these incredible projects, the railroad being one of them, the Three Gorges Dam being another, to bypass all of the kind of bureaucratic wrangling or even kind of democratic obstacles that we would deal with here and to execute visions. It may be difficult or may prove difficult in the near-term economic environment, but I think in the long term, China will benefit from having pushed through these great development projects quickly.
They put restrictions on factories, construction, cars, mining to cut down pollution for the Olympics, and those measures have have caused a major shutdown of the economy. I think one quarter of the economy has been forced to shut down.
Mm-hmm. There is nothing more important in China than these Olympics. And though we recognize that on some level on a daily basis, I still believe that that the importance is widely underestimated. Much of China's identity for the last 6 or 7, 8 years has been tied to this idea of the Olympics and what's begun this week. And it is simply more important than anything else, economy included.
National pride. And it obviously has spread. There are people who left China many years ago and had a lot of negative feelings about the homeland, who's suddenly feeling a new kind of nationalistic pride.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Nationalism is very intense in China and among Chinese, in my experience, and there's good reason to be proud. The Olympics are a major coming out for this country on the world stage.
On the other hand, the Olympics have focused attention on the drawbacks of China's rapid growth, the overwhelming pollution, congestion, the destruction of historic buildings. Will the intense scrutiny pressure China to make any changes, do you think?
It may. I don't think this is just an Olympic phenomenon. I think that as China edges closer and closer to a more democratic process, it is increasingly in many ways having to cope with the existence of both good and bad in the same realm. And, you know, I think that that's just life. But I think China would prefer to believe or culturally put forward the notion that everything is okay and not really focus on the pollution that exists or the unemployment that exists or the wide gulf between rich and poor, which is something that the country deals with. And the more it opens up to international news focus and international conversation and things like the Olympics, the more it's difficult to deny those other elements.
My guest is Abram Lustgarten. His book, China's Great Train, Beijing's Drive West, and the Campaign to Remake Tibet, published by Times Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I wonder whether China even has to consider changing. Their human rights record hasn't hurt them on the international scene all that much, at least not economically, and because I guess China's such a huge market and everybody wants a piece of it and is willing to look the other way. They haven't been hurt by their support of Sudan, even though there have been many campaigns to call attention to it. And I could probably go down a long list of other things where they've been culpable, and nobody seems to really care.
It's true, and that's a somewhat disturbing fact. It's very difficult to put pressure on China, and China has never responded well either to international pressure, so it's questionable whether that kind of pressure is an effective tool. Many people have long held out hope that the change would happen organically within China, and I think to some degree that's largely happening. And with Tibet, people hoped for a long, long time that China's liberalization in the East would be trickling towards Tibet and would lead to a gradual shift there. Unfortunately, I think since the protests that happened there in March and have been on some scale ongoing, things are actually headed in a disturbing opposite direction. But the general trend in China, I think, is a growing worldliness of its people and awareness of world issues and probably a desire from internal communities to begin this shift.
I have to wonder whether the Russian invasion of Georgia won't embolden the Chinese to some degree.
It could. It'll be interesting to watch that. China's very bold in this regard as it is, and I would be curious to see what could embolden them further.
When the Qinghai-Tibet line was being built, there were a lot of cover-ups, weren't there? The people died, and that was not revealed. Workers were forced to continue working despite warnings that tracks were unstable and highly dangerous. The transparency that so many people predicted with the growth of industry doesn't really seem to be coming.
True. These are relatively small cover-ups, as you say, though. I mean, Chinese society in general is extremely opaque. There was a limitation of communication of facts and stories relayed around the building of the railway. I think there was a desire to keep everything very positive and upbeat and have everybody believe that workers are healthy and strong and enthusiastic. But I think the cover-up is if you want to call it that, is small compared to, for example, the lack of conversation since the March protests in Tibet, about what is happening in Tibet. That's to me a much greater sort of silencing of media in China and of communication of facts coming out of China.
So how do people even find out? After all, as we saw with reporters at the Olympics, you can't get an awful lot of information off of the internet. So much of it is blocked.
How do people inside of China find out?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or do they?
In many cases, they do not. And in many cases, they do through the Western media outlets that are not blocked. Xinhua and the other Chinese media outlets do cover many of these issues. They just cover them lightly and without the kind of black and white stance that we might take here in the news. So they are still valuable sources of information. And then there's lots of communication with Chinese people who are living overseas.
And is it your sense that right now the Chinese government is holding back on applying more pressure in Tibet because of the Olympics, once the Olympics are over?
It's extremely difficult to know what's happening inside of Tibet. It's my impression from reading recent reports and a new study that came out last week from the International Campaign for Tibet looking at what's happening inside of Tibet now and since March. It looks like it's a highly repressive environment. I think that there is a large-scale crackdown that's been happening since March. And whether that gets worse after the Olympics, some people will speculate that that's the case, that whatever they may have been withholding up until now, they'll feel no reason to withhold following the Olympics. On the other hand, it could ease. It's very difficult to know what's happening and where things will go.
If you want to go to Lhasa, is this the best way to go? Buy a seat on that railroad?
I think it's absolutely the most interesting way to go. If you have the stamina for a 48-hour train journey, yes. You can also fly.
Are there places to sleep?
Sorry?
Are there places to sleep on the train?
There is. Their second and third class cabins are sleeper cabins. First class is four bunks in a room, and second class is six. And they're quite comfortable. They even have, if you speak Mandarin and can understand them, little LCD TV screens to entertain yourself.
You were here recently on Brian Lehrer's show to talk about natural gas, another interest totally?
Another interest totally, yes.
And this is not something that you could connect to Tibet. Is there natural gas? What kind of resources are there? I understand there is talk of some oil in the region.
Well, I generally have spent a lot of time reporting on resource issues and oil and gas around the world, and that's part of what did interest me in Tibet, and I guess that's the bridge to what I'm working on now. In Tibet, there are massive resources. The domestic oil companies, Sinopec, for one, talk about massive reserves to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, maybe some of the largest oil reserves in the world. Though they're unproven, and it's very difficult to know if that's true. There's also metals and copper and iron. They're some of the largest deposits in China.
Which would mean that there's no way China would leave, because right now China is dependent on the Middle East for its oil, isn't it?
It is. I don't believe
more and more Africa.
Mm-hmm. Both of those. I don't believe that there's any likelihood of China leaving Tibet, and partially because of the resource wealth that's there, and also because it's a bridge to Pakistan and to China's access to the waters of the Persian Gulf and to major shipping lanes for oil.
Do the people of Tibet know about the deaths in the building of the railroad?
The few stories that I heard about deaths in the construction crews came from Tibetans. They came from people in small villages in the middle of nowhere who told me stories about seeing workers buried.
Mm-hmm. Would they the local residents get any money from the resources that might be found in their area?
I'm not clear on the royalty laws in Tibet at this moment. There is a structure for some of that money to come into the local economy. There's also a long history of those taxes and other monies being funneled back out through various mechanisms back into other Chinese provinces.
Now that you've written this book, do you think that you might be unwelcome if you went back?
I suspect I was unwelcome a long time ago, but I never ran into any trouble, and I'm not clear on how adept China is at keeping track of who's coming through its borders. There are people who are very interested in this book and would not take issue with it, but the government, I'm sure, would just as soon I stay clear.
Do you think part of the problem for Western nations in dealing with Tibet is that It's difficult to decide whether this is a political or a religious matter. Most of the advocates for Tibet are foreign Buddhists rather than people who just see a major injustice being committed.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely part of it, and it both keeps the issue on the forefront and also muddies the waters, as you say, a little bit. The perspectives and the voices of Tibetan advocacy groups in the United States and in Germany and throughout Europe and of course in Dharamsala in India, the Tibetan government in exile, are very strong. They very aggressively push forward their view of the Tibetan situation and their view of what's happening in China. And there's lots to sympathize with there, and there's also some things to be cautious of in terms of their message.
Same thing is happening with the Falun Gong, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And that just, I think, gets to the larger issue of China not being particularly hospitable to individual religious practice.
Because of its own history? Or I think because Buddhism has a long history in China.
It does, of course.
And one of the greatest works of literature, Monkey, is all about the monks from India who brought Buddhism to China.
My impression is that there is not that China is taking offense at the actual religious beliefs of Buddhism or of Falun Gong, but that they feel threatened by the collectivization, the community that forms around these religions.
Abram Lustgarten's book is China's Great Train, Beijing's Drive West and the Campaign to Remake Tibet, published by Times Books, which is an imprint of Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.